Welcome to the ACO Show. This is Sean Cavanaugh, and I'm joined by my colleague, Josh Israel. Today, we interview Charlie Barber, the author of Peace and Health, a book about Mark Maselli, the founder and now president and CEO of Community Health Center in Connecticut. They tell the remarkable story of the founding of this health center and its ultimate expansion and success.
Yeah, it's a fun book. It's sort of certainly a tale of the creation of something that started very hard scrabble and has turned into a big success. It's a fun book, sort of a coffee table book. And again, we bring attention to community health centers, this corner of America that does such an important service and is just not well known enough. So I am always glad to learn more about it.
Yeah, let's get to them and hear the remarkable story of this place.
All right, we have the pleasure now to be joined by Charlie Barber, who's a writer in residence at Wesleyan University, and Mark Maselli, who's the president and CEO of Community Health Centers in Middletown, Connecticut. Welcome to you both.
Good to be here.
Thank you, Dr. Israel.
So your book, Charlie, Peace and Health, it tells the fantastic story of the creation and growth of this community health center in Middletown, Connecticut. How did you come to write this book?
Mark asked me. but I've known Mark. We don't know exactly for how long, but for a long time. And I had been an observer and a fan of the health center for decades. And I actually grew up in Middletown as well. So I knew Mark growing up a little bit. And then their 50th anniversary was looming and Mark contacted me. He had read a previous book I wrote called Citizen Outlaw about a reform gangster in New Haven and came to a reading and met the guy that I wrote the book about. And so I think Mark, who is a visionary, saw, not that that's an equivalent story, but in a weird way, it's about a guy that unexpectedly changed the world. This guy's become a very influential, what they call violence interrupter. And then I also placed the book in the research in the field of criminal justice. So Mark contacted me, and beware anybody who Mark contacts about a project, because it had first started as a couple of articles. And then very happily, it grew and grew and grew. And one of the really important things is that Mark, to the finished product, it was not supposed to have any images in it whatsoever. I was going to write a monograph. But along the way, I guess two things happened. One is Mark had hired a really incredible archivist. She actually was the archivist at the Mark Twain House in Hartford. And she had been working for a couple years on the imagery, the historic imagery and documentation around the health center. So when I got wind of that, and then I have worked very closely with a book designer in Connecticut, and we kind of put two and two together between the visual record and then my designer friend. And so the book kind of went on steroids in terms of the narrative and the imagery. And it just got deeper and deeper for all of us. This was kind of at the height of Zoom. So Mark and I did a lot of our interviews on Zoom, the height of COVID, but the interviews got richer and richer and richer. So the narrative concomitantly got deeper and deeper, the written narrative. And, you know, this is where we ended up.
Mark, so we just heard a reference to a writer in residence, an archivist. You're running these beautiful health centers across the state. This is all very different than the beginning of the book, which starts with you in a sleeping bag, sleeping outside of an abandoned building. You want to tell us a little bit about the founding of the health center?
Yeah, well, it actually starts a few years earlier, where a group of us had formed a crisis intervention center for young people. And it was a drop-in center. Peer counseling was going on. We had a draft center. We had a free library, free clothing store, a little bit of San Francisco in there, really thinking about how we could help shape public policy and practically help young people who were facing real challenges at that point. And so we started off with this, it's called Touch Crisis Intervention Center. But along the way, it was pretty common that most of the young people coming in and their families, in some cases, all had a common theme, which is they lacked access to primary care. And at the same time, I became aware of the work that David Smith, Dr. Smith, was doing at Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic. And somehow found myself as a 20-year-old at the formation of the National Free Clinic Council in D.C. in a meeting at the Shoreham Hotel in January of 72, and found my people in terms of these were people who really wanted to change the world and were sort of moving outside of the federal government, just saying, hey, why can't we do this on our own? And so we planted a flag that healthcare is a right, not a privilege. And we set up in a second floor walk-up. We say in the book, you could have been in San Francisco, you know, tie-dye, beaded curtains, that slight scent of incense, Sometimes it was incense that sort of wafted through that. Young people from Wesleyan came together, Middletown activists came together, and we started a free clinic. Interestingly, and probably to our success over the long term, the first group of people who really glommed onto us were dentists. And so our first service was dental services. And you think about the trajectory of how long it took. And we were a mental health program, right? Because we were doing counseling downstairs. Right there within that first year, we were a fully integrated medical, dental, and behavioral health program. We had two heads for most people in the state who just sort of looked at us and said, you got them all together, you know, and we were literally a small second floor walk up, but we had this conceptual model that was in place and it helped in terms of the DNA of the health center. This makes sense on a lot of levels, came together for different reasons. But then we woke up to the reality of a door knock from the state health department saying, do you have a license? Us saying, do you need a license? And the reality was, yes, we do need a license. And they were not happy, had sort of been ginned up by the local medical society at that time. And you can understand why we've all subsequently become friends. But at that point, all single shingles in the United States, you know, outside of some cities, but basically it was a closed network for anybody else trying to get in there. And the public practice of medicine, at least where we were, was not present or prominent at all. And they found a way to close us down. It happened to be our hallways were an inch too narrow. And then it led to me trying to figure out with less money than we had before, how were we going to survive, and ended up, and Charlie nicely does it in sort of the prologue of the book, captures sleeping out for a couple of nights, waiting to see if I could literally wrestle some space from somebody who would occupy it.
Mark, you mentioned sort of a bit of San Francisco and all of this. One of my favorite anecdotes that you recount from the book, Charlie, is that you went to a national conference in DC and the opening session was started by Wavy Gravy, who tried to open the session by levitating the world. So I do think it probably was a different time back then. You referenced the local medical community trying to block this center from starting up. Community health centers are now probably not as well known as they should be, as such an important place in our system for getting free care to the uninsured and underinsured. What were people doing back then if you didn't have health insurance? What were you supposed to do?
You were going to the emergency room. And then the other way you get into it is every doc would have, just come and talk to me and I'll make the decision. Well, that's not a system, right? That's sort of one off. I think over time, people rightfully challenged things and questioned, and all that strengthened us and with a much better relationship across the board. But back then, it was open warfare. They simply did not want somebody making decisions that they had taken onto themselves before. So different times. But I think the question, Josh, about the health center world, it's kind of a strange one. Here we are, the largest health system in America. And out of 10 people, I don't think anybody would identify that federally qualified health center is a community health center. 31 million people. Those are 31 million people who come in a 12-month period. That's 50 million because we know we'd love people to come all, but they don't come. So I think there are about 50 million registered Americans or people who live in the country who come and use them, and 1,400 organizations, 10,000 locations. It's a big system. And I think HRSA has done a great job, the Health Resource Service Administration, in really trying to frame up, okay, access. The question we've always asked here at the health center, it's not about access. It's access to what, right? You need a comprehensive, high-performing health organization that's dynamic. And I think there's inconsistencies in the system. And I think HRSA has been trying to raise the floor each and every time. More data on health centers than any other system in the country. I mean, just in terms of performance that are measured, the unified data systems that are collected by HRSA, analyzed by lots of researchers and the like. But you're right, folks down the street wouldn't know who we are from Adam. They think we're a health club.
It's very much in the news now that people in healthcare are starting to think about the social determinants of health. What role does poverty and racism play in determining health? And what should the health system do to respond to that? As Charlie makes clear in the book, the roots of your health center and everything you've done started with the anti-poverty movement and became healthcare out of that movement rather than the other way around. Can you talk more about the social movements that influenced your thinking that led to the creation of the center?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And really, you look at Johnson's War on Poverty, the anti-poverty organizations that were growing up at the same time and were out looking at housing insecurity, looking at food insecurity. who were really trying to help build. And as I think we think about it now, I would say this is also, in terms of the behavioral health area, the social isolation that people have. And this is about the lack of social capital in communities, right? If you've read Robert Putnam, Bowling Alone, you know that there's a real issue that we have in our country that takes us outside of the four walls of our healthcare operation, right? Outside of the behavioral health services that we provide in there. How do you start cultivating those? And I think that's increasingly, we're seeing this in value-based care. I've got somebody with asthma. I'm not sending them home with an air conditioner. I'm sending home a script. Things that don't make sense, sending them back into the same environment. We've been thinking about it, but you're right. At that time, there was a whole group that they just didn't come together. The health system and that anti-poverty organization really didn't merge up. There was a lack of funding, lack of maybe creativity that sort of pushed that off to the most recent past, the last decade, where there's been a focus in on that. Certainly in the anti-poverty movement, the issue of racial inequities loom large as well. But again, that's taken a long time. Probably the George Floyd tragedy really brought it more in focus, but the social determinants of health are very important to be focused in on now. And I think one of the things we do, and while we're a community health center, I should just share with your listeners that we've actually created a health system above that. So we now have the Moses Weitzman Health System, which overarches that. And within that is the Weitzman Institute, which is our research institute based in DC, where we are really focused on implementation and improvement science and done lots of publications, Lancet, JAMA, all across the board, looking at a wide range of issues. But below that are the health center, which we're talking about today. But we have three other organizations, our National Institute for Medical Assistance in Denver, and we're about 26 states where we're training medical assistants on the Tom Bodenheimer, Ed Wagner model of team-based care, right? And they've never been professionalized. We run a nonprofit, about 7,000 to train them. Traditionally, it's 20,000 plus, put them in debt. And they're never trained in a team-based environment. They're sort of trained virtually, and then they're, for the last 3 weeks, put into a safety net hospital or something else. The entire 8 months is embedded in a safety net hospital or a federally qualified health center. California office, we run the consortium. Margaret Flinner, who co-pilots the health center with me, formed the first nurse practitioner residency program in America 16 years ago. There are 523 now. We're an accrediting body. So we accredit Emory and Seattle Children's Hospital, other places. And then finally, the fourth organization below this system is ConfirMed, run by Dr. Anderson. We cover about 5 million lives for access to e-consults, really for Medicaid and uninsured populations across the country. We have 300 specialists who work for us. This is the biggest failing in healthcare right now, is we have lots of people who need to see specialists who never get to a specialist because they're Black, they're Brown, they're on Medicaid, they're uninsured, they live in rural areas and the like. And we've been building program, and all those fall into this not-for-profit system that we have that grew out of that story that Charlie told, which is this beginning of a small free clinic. And we have a saying that if you're going to be engaged in the provision of primary care, you have an obligation to improve it. And I think we've been working steadily towards that.
You are nationally known now. I had actually known about the Weitzman Institute even before I knew about your health center, but you started out very local. And Charlie, in your research, I wonder, was there anything you think unique about where this clinic started that helped it grow? You know, I know that there was an involvement of a current U.S. senator. Was there anything about being in this college town in particular that helped the creation of this?
Well, you mentioned, you referred to John Hickenlooper, current senator from Colorado, who's part of the book, helped found the organization with Mark when he was a college student at Wesleyan in the 70s, and has been a fan of the book, and we've appeared a number of times together. So I interviewed John for the book, couldn't get him off the phone. And I think there were extreme advantages and disadvantages to starting this in Middletown, Connecticut. And John said, basically, is the worst place to start a healthcare organization. It's middle of the road, Middletown. It's a small place. I talk in the book about Connecticut is often called the land of steady habits, sort of naturally conservative, so not disposed to a disruptor like Mark. And John was pretty clear, this is like the worst place to do this. And Mark would say, and I say both things in the book, but I think Mark would say it's the best place to do it. One was Mark, his parents grew up and grandparents grew up in the neighborhood where he's at right now. Like a block from where he is right now. So local, everything is local, as I think Tip O'Neill and John Lennon said in different ways. and knowing the community through and through, as opposed to imposing a model from above, which is still absolutely the model as the health center expands. And then Westland has been a tremendous advantage over the years. Hickenlooper, for example. But there were a number of Westland students sort of in and out of school, as we were saying, is sort of a different time. People are kind of dropped out. There was a strike at Westland over the Vietnam War. And this goes back to the touch period that Mark was talking about, the pre-health center. But Westland students kind of went downtown for the first time and wanted to help out and were highly politicized and looking at the civil rights movement. So Westland has provided a steady flow of talented people. And then Mark, like me, was a faculty brat at Westland. My dad taught here, as did Mark's. And Mark availed himself essentially of a Westland education when he was starting the health center and spent a lot of time with particular faculty members who influenced him. And the education became official when he was given an honorary doctorate 10, 15 years ago. But just one example is there was a world-famous ethnomusicology tradition at Westland. And so in the early 70s, when Mark is doing all of this, their master musicians from the East are setting up a gamelan. And Mark observed all of this and went to a lot of the concerts and took that sort of melange of talent and had told me in these extensive interviews that we did that he saw himself as sort of, I think a conductor is too reductionistic, but he saw the mix of talent. And then also a big part of the book is local community leaders having nothing to do or very little to do with Westland, in particular, Reba Moses, who was a leader of the faith community in Middletown and also a social activist, and then Jerry Weitzman, both of whom are now the namesakes of the health system that Mark was referring to. Jerry was a successful businessman, a pharmacist downtown, and they were mentors in different ways for Mark. So at the local level, I think Hickenlooper was saying at a systems level, Middletown was the worst place to do it. But I think at a local level, it was the best place to do it.
I just want to expand on one thing. The way you threw the word gamelan in there, you gave yourself away as Wesleyan, as if most of the world will understand what that meant. Do you want to explain what a gamelan is?
I think Mark can do it better than I can.
Well, in Indonesia, the gamelan is a sort of an orchestra of different instruments, and we always go to concerts and sit quietly. The gamelan is a place where people are playing music, and there's the wayang, people are telling puppet stories, and people are just chatting around if you were in a party and just coming together. It's a great instrument to bring people together, but there are 40 plus pieces of instrumentation that people are playing. So, and it was out of the World's Fair that Westland took that gamelan that came in 60 and somehow became a leader in ethnomusicology. The folks from South India came, and Indonesia came, and Africa came, and there are a lot of forces coursing through the university at that point.
Mark, the book does an amazing job of chronicling the 50 years and the struggles to get the health center up and running, and then each stage of development to the point where you are. My background is in healthcare policy. Can you identify 2, 3, or 4 major policy changes that turned you from a struggling, cash-strapped organization to one that was able to grow and add services and become sustainable in the long run?
Yeah. And the unlikely president at that time was George H. Bush, who had signed a bill that allowed health centers to get cost-based reimbursement back in 1989. And I think that had a profound impact. We took it as a force multiplier in terms of the work that we're doing. From that sort of one location we have, we're in 200 locations across the state now. But we use that in terms of really a major change. And then certainly the Affordable Care Act was the other game changer in terms of the work. There were many others that were coming along, but those were two big, allowed the health centers move. Of course, cost-based reimbursement doesn't really exist any longer, but it did for a long time. And it varies now by all 50 states versus when the feds had more oversight. They've sort of turned it back there. But it's been very helpful. Never turn a gift horse away. And it was a real gift. And then the long struggle to really 21 million Americans now in the Affordable Care Act. That is so important. But there's so much work to be done. And you all are doing incredible work at Aledade. And Margaret and I have hosted a national podcast like you guys have. for 16 years now, and Farsad Ustashari was on that. We watched with great admiration of the work that the Bloomberg administration did, and not surprised that you all are thinking out of the box, trying to reimagine the delivery system. And how do you do that? Got to have a lot of bright and talented people and continue to plug away at it.
Well, Mark, you mentioned Aledade. So of all the changes you have been through, there's been a relatively new one, which is your community health center joined an accountable care organization. You joined the Aledade Network. Can you speak to why you would do that?
Well, one, it's come late for Connecticut because, not because of you guys, but Connecticut's been, as Charlie said, he forgot the last part of this. It's a land of steady habits, but none of them are good. So we've not, and lots of good things happen here, but too often it had been stopped. But I think we've got to rethink the reimbursement system and the incentives across the board in terms of how people are paid. We say at the health center, just one of our mantras is that we're building a world-class primary care organization committed to serving special populations, focused on improving patient outcomes and cultivating healthy communities. But improving patient outcomes is a complicated world. Unless you bring the analytics together, the critical thinking together, the delivery system together, you simply can't do it. And Aledade is really thinking about, how do you frame all of that up? How are you able to conceptualize this model? And it requires lots of data in the back end. It requires lots of analysis. And it requires kindred spirits who are excited about the transformation that could be out there and willingness to explore interventions. And those that are successful, data-driven, let's use them and figure out how to spread them out. So we're excited about the partnership and are rooting for Aledade's success, as we do others in the field who are trying to improve patient outcomes. We're, again, and I get back to that, access to what? It's good that people have access, but if we're not really looking hard at ourselves and saying, well, it's a good story, but what has it done in terms of patient outcomes? And I think that's why we built this larger system and why Aledade is around doing the same thing, is we've got to get better outcomes. And we have to get it better. Back, Josh, you were talking about the disparity issues. We have to get back to make sure racial and ethnic minorities benefit from these, and they simply haven't.
Well, Charlie, after this great book, what are you working on next?
Well, Mark and I have been very happy with the reception to Peace and Health. And so we're kicking around, or more than kicking around, ideas for some kind of a follow-up. We're potentially looking at a documentary and maybe another book project. And so we're, you know, actively looking at that. Well, I had another book out since Peace and Health came out called In the Blood, about two local guys, another nonfiction book, two local guys in Connecticut who invented improbably a blood clotting product. They were industrialists, had nothing to do with medicine or the military, but realized a ground up mineral that they were using to separate gases could clot blood, believe it or not, and they were correct. And so it was brought to the attention of the military and is in the first aid kit of every soldier and Marine as we speak now, and NYPD and on and on. So it's the story of that success, but also, like Mark's story, and Mark has read the book, it's about the struggle. And it's one of those things 30 years in the making of the breakthrough. And so it's part of a series that I've done, really, of people that have changed the world in unexpected ways.
Well, Charlie Barber, Mark Maselli, thank you both for joining us today and sharing the story of the Community Health Center in Connecticut.
Thank you for the time. Good meeting you both.
The ACO Show now has a mailbag. Submit your questions, compliments, or episode ideas to acoshow@aledade.com. This show was produced by Leanne Horst, Alana Coogan, Rebecca Raymond, and Stuart Taylor. Check out more of our show wherever you get your podcast. Thanks for listening.